You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places. In fact, to the very streets of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiotakis. On the northeast edge of downtown LA, tucked away between Union Station and Philippe's original French dip, is the oldest street in the city. It's right next to the oldest church in the city and the oldest plaza, too. The street is only 600 feet long for pedestrians only, a brick-paved lane that's a marketplace, theme park, and a living museum. Welcome, bienvenidos, to Olvera Street.
You can't come to LA and not come to Olvera Street.
Enjoy the music, the food,
all the color, and all the history.
The huaraches, the sarapes.
It's like Disneyland.
Actually, Olvera Street is a lot like Disneyland in the historic heart of the city, an authentic slice of Southern California in its own distinctively inauthentic way. Today on Greater LA, a Mexican marketplace created almost 100 years ago by a woman who'd never been to Mexico, celebrating a completely imagined history on the very spot where this city was born. Here's reporter Mike Schlitt.
It all started with a whim. The idea that maybe L.A. didn't measure up to all the hype it got back in 1926 when a divorced socialite from San Francisco moved to town.
The booklets and folders I read about Los Angeles were painted in colors of Spanish-Mexican romance.
That's the socialite in question, Christine Sterling. Actually, it's an actress reading passages from her book. The book is called
Olvera Street, El Pueblo de Nuestra Señora, La Reina de Los Angeles. Its history and restoration.
This is Los Angeles, sprawling metropolis of the West. Almost engulfed by the city surrounding it, lies a little street, Olvera Street. Here, a group of 11 Mexican families founded El Pueblo de Nuestra Señora La Reina de Los Angeles, the city of Our Lady, the Queen of the Angels.
Christine Sterling explores Los Angeles, her new hometown. It's not what she expects.
The attractive literature which Los Angeles sends out drew me as it has thousands of others. The sunshine, mountains, beaches, palm trees were here, but where was the romance of the past? Old missions, rambling adobes, the strumming of guitars and the click of castanets. I visited the old plaza, the birthplace of the city, and found it forsaken and forgotten. Down a dirty alley, I discovered an old adobe, dignified even in its decay. Across the front door was nailed a black and white sign, Condemned.
She stands in an abandoned alley, staring out at 26 buildings scheduled for demolition. And in that moment, Christine Sterling has a vision.
I closed my eyes and thought of the plaza as a Spanish-American social and commercial center. It would furnish Los Angeles with the greatest tourist attraction she may ever have. A spot of beauty as a gesture of appreciation for our historical past.
Yeah, about that historical past.
Los Angeles history is an ongoing story of conquest, displacement, and loss.
That's LA historian William Estrada. And this is what he's talking about.
The Tongva-Gabrielino people are the original inhabitants of Los Angeles.
The Gabrielinos farmed the land. The Spanish took the land from the Gabrielinos. The Californios took the land from the Spanish. The United States government took the land from the Californios. That's what we call progress. On Olvera Street, progress meant
the crime, the filth of everything. A woman dying of consumption in a dirty room, sewer water running down the street from broken pipes, and then they fight me because I want to clean it up.
But Christine Sterling's faith never wavered. She was a fervent believer in romance and capitalism.
August 3rd, 1926. Called today on Harry Chandler of The Times. He is a very busy man, but not too busy to talk of idealism and sentiment.
Harry Chandler, publisher of the LA Times, was arguably the most powerful man in the city. He owned a lot of real estate near Olvera Street, and he knew a popular tourist site there would boost his property value. It would also help accelerate his plan to build a Union Station right next door.
Harry Chandler had agreed to support Christine Sterling, but he wasn't going to do it with just his money. He called one of his famous luncheons. It was well known that if Harry Chandler called you into a luncheon, you better bring your checkbook.
Each one of his guests chipped in $5,000.
To form a for-profit organization headed by Chandler for the restoration and the creation of Olvera Street. From there on, Christine Sterling was back in business.
I feel like Cinderella when the fairy godmother changed the pumpkin into a fine coach and the rats into prancing horses. November 7, 1929. Work started this morning on Olvera Street. 25 prisoners put the first picks and shovels into the dirt of the old street.
You heard that right. The workers were prisoners, personally provided to Christine Sterling by the chief of police.
The prisoners were good workers. One escaped, but we managed to keep the others. November 21. One of the prisoners is a good carpenter, another an electrician. Each night I pray they will arrest a bricklayer and a plumber. November 24. My prayers answered with just a slight error. Two bricklayers and no plumber. Concédenos el cielo la realización de este sueño. Heaven bring to fulfillment this dream. December 25. Prisoners had a little Christmas party in the patio of the adobe. In the cellar of the Pelinconi house, prisoners dug up several cases of whiskey while the guard was on the other end of the street. Truck had to take them back to jail. March 10th. Street work completed. Not a penny over the estimated cost. We have made little awning stands, or puestos, for the street. Each one will be given to a Mexican family, and they will sell all things typical of Mexico. Tourists will be interested in their wares, and not only will this mean a living for the Mexican, but it will make the street picturesque and colorful.
Christine Sterling's Olvera Street opened to the public Easter Sunday, 1930. It was an instant success.
Thousands of people came, and everyone seemed happy. Out of the heart of the Mexican people is spun the gold of romance and contentment. No sweeter, finer people live on this earth. And whatever evil anyone might believe about them has been bred in the darkness of ignorance and prejudice.
She did contribute to that ignorance and prejudice, hiring actors to portray campesinos fast asleep underneath a cactus on Olvera Street, and then having merchants sell ceramic, lazy Mexican keychains.
Oh, darn it. I'm all out of film.
Oh, now isn't that a shame? And he's so picturesque.
Oh, yeah.
The lazy Mexican.
That's from the opening scene of The Ring, a 1952 boxing movie about racial discrimination.
What's the matter? Take a little punishment?
When the new Union Station opened, displacing thousands of Chinese locals, Christine Sterling built a brand new ethno-cultural faux historic commerce zone. She called it China City. The China City brochure said,
American-promoted, Chinese-operated amusement center, designed to attract tourists.
But China City was far less successful than the Mexican marketplace next door. It was destroyed by fire, possibly arson, in 1948.
Most ideals are destined to be destroyed by human imperfections.
Christine Sterling continued to run Olvera Street's day-to-day operations until her death in 1963. And, like much of Los Angeles history, her legacy is complicated.
Olvera Street is a fantasy idea of Mexico for the tourists.
Some people think Christine Sterling's make-believe Mexico land is paternalistic, naive.
It's so racist, you know? It's like this is a theme park, right? Where you go see the natives play.
While that may be true, there is no denying that Christine Sterling saved Olvera Street from the bulldozers, and she cared deeply about its merchant community. People like Mike Mariscal, who's been working at his family's store on Olvera Street for 62 years.
Mrs. Sterling was really a visionary. For her to just create this place and then to help poor Latino families to survive, that's what this place was born on.
Businesses on Olvera Street have been passed down through families from generation to generation. That's the way Christine Sterling wanted it.
We're this little gem. We are business owners. We are mom and pop shops. We are cultural, historical resources that continue traditions.
Mike's daughter, Christina, is fifth generation Olvera Street.
When you're here, you feel a sense of coming home.
And that's not just the case for merchant families.
The Latino community embraces this place like crazy. They got to come to Olvera Street. They got to come to La Placita Church. I mean, they must do hundreds of baptisms every weekend.
Nearly 100 years of life on the street have added whole new layers to the story.
For Mexican Americans in Southern California, this is where you come. This is where you hang out on a Saturday or a Sunday, walk around, eat, spend time with the family.
Christine Sterling's celebration of an imagined past continues to resonate today. Local history may be an ongoing story of conquest, displacement, and loss. But at least for now,
we're still here, you know? That, to me, is much more significant than the tchotchke you might pick up.
From the birthplace of Los Angeles, for KCRW on Olvera Street, I'm Mike Schlint. Bonito tu trajecito,
cuánto das por la apariencia. Special thanks to actress Valerie Spencer for her readings from Christine Sterling's book. Brillante tu amiguito, te pasaste de la cuenta. Muy fancy tu relojito, es de downtown, no me mientas. Tu vida se ve oscura sin el brillo en la moneda. Nada, nada se te luce si no es nuevo.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Moving on now with Greater LA on KCRW, I'm Steve Chiotakis. LA is experimenting with a guaranteed income program. You have to meet certain criteria, like living in LA County, your job and pay being affected by COVID, and your household income being lower than the median of your neighborhood. You have to apply and be selected for this program called Breathe. But if you are selected, you'll be one of 1,000 people to get $1,000 a month for 3 years. Applications run through April 13th. To give a rundown of the program, Eli Fournier is here. He's the department director of SBCC, or Strength-Based Community Change. This is a nonprofit that the county teamed up with to bring Breathe to certain Angelenos. Hey, Eli.
Hi. How are you?
I'm all right. Tell us a little bit about this program, Breathe. I mean, how do you see it helping, you know, the average Angeleno, somebody who's been really struggling over the past couple of years?
Yeah, definitely. So I know you touched on the basics, the main bullets for this, but this is a monthly cash payment given directly to individuals, and it's unconditional with no strings attached on how you spend it and no work requirements. And this an opportunity like this isn't supposed to take the place of an income or a job, but it's really creating more breathing room. And that's where the name Breathe comes from, for many of our LA County residents that have been affected by COVID and are struggling. And an opportunity like this could really propel them and help them to push forward and have some extra breathing room to pay bills, to cover rent, or to use the money as they need for their family.
How is your organization, the SBCC, how's it been working to get the word out to people about this?
Yeah, so SBCC was selected as the program administrator, and a big part of our role was outreach and engagement. But we realized we can't do this work alone. And so in the last 2 months, we've reached out and partnered with over 70 organizations, local grassroots organizations across the county that would disseminate disinformation and get it out to the people and folks that need it the most. One of the things about this program is when you hear the details of something like this, for many residents, there's a trust piece there that, well, is this even real? Would I even apply? Is this something that I could do? And so by partnering with organizations that have those rooted relationships with residents across the county, the information comes across, I believe, stronger, more clear. And not only that, the other part to this is that we've created over 50 enrollment centers. We know not everyone has access to internet, not everyone has a computer, and we do have populations that see technology as something that's intimidating. And we think this type of support we'll get those that are most in need to be able to fill out the application.
I mentioned some of the criteria at the top, and you know, we're talking about different qualifications. Can you walk us through some of them?
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, the five main things or criteria to be eligible for this that you have to be able to hit is, one, to apply, you have to be 18 years or older. Secondly, you have to live in a Los Angeles County neighborhood that falls at or below the county's area median household income. I'm going to pause there because as folks hear this, they may not know, okay, does my neighborhood, does my zip code fall under the area's median income? And to do that, I do recommend you can go to breathe.lacounty.gov, and we have a tool there when you go to the website where you can put your address, and it'll quickly let you know if you fall under that category and if you're eligible. The three other eligibilities is that you have a household income that falls at or below the county's AMI, area median income. So for a single person household, that is at or below $56,000. Another example, for a family of four, that is at or below $96,000 a year. The last two bullets for eligibility is that you have been negatively affected by COVID-19. And then five, that you're not currently enrolled in another guaranteed income program. The city of LA launched their guaranteed income program a few months ago. There's other cities like Compton that has a program like this. So you can't be enrolled in another program similar to this for you to be able to qualify.
What's been the response so far from folks as far as the application process? Because you opened applications when? Last week, right?
Yeah. Applications open and they're live. And the response, I mean, has been incredible. I guess in two parts, right? One is there are thousands and thousands of people that have already applied. And it's exciting and it's good to see that the information and the outreach and the engagement has gone out and folks are hearing about this program. And they're applying. The sad part of that, though, is it is a reminder of the need that we have here in LA County for many of our residents, that an opportunity like this could truly make an impact and really set a trajectory for them moving forward. Another thing to remember is that, you know, for this program, we're talking about a three-year program. So for the 1,000 residents that do get selected through this randomized process, they will be receiving $1,000 a month for 3 years. So imagine the impact to having this extra money for 3 years and what it can do for a family.
What do you say to somebody who's like, oh, this is too good to be true? Like, there are, you say no strings attached, but something's going on. They're tracking me. They're tracking what I spend the money on. They're going to have access to my bank account. There are a lot of people who are, you know, who feel like this is maybe too good to be true.
Yeah. I think for us and our partners and the county, I mean, transparency was key. And in getting this information and disseminating it and getting it out to the public from the get-go, that transparency of reminding folks, this is a research project. And so there is data that's going to be collected for the impact of what something like this can do. Now, going back to our strategy in engaging CBOs and engaging grassroots organizations to share this information has made a difference, because when there's that trust and you're hearing this information, not just through a sign or a billboard or because you got a flyer, but real people that are in your neighborhood that you trust has helped this process. And all we can do is share the information and let folks make the decision for themselves.
Eli Fournier, the department director over at SBCC. Eli, thanks for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW, a story of constitutional obstruction with ties to Orange County. It's been more than a year since the January 6th insurrection attack on the United States Capitol. Remember that one? Well, last week, a U.S. district judge found that former Chapman University Law School Dean John Eastman and former President Donald Trump, quote, dishonestly conspired to obstruct the joint session of Congress on January 6, 2021. Well, that's putting Eastman's actions and even Chapman's actions under the microscope. Here to tell us more is Gustavo Arellano, columnist for the LA Times, a regular here, of course, on GLA. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
I want to start with Eastman himself. Who is he? Like I mentioned, he was the former dean at Chapman's Law School. How did he get involved with President Trump?
Yeah, full disclosure, Chapman University is my alma mater. I got my bachelor's in film studies, which I obviously have never used in my career. But Eastman was a longtime gadfly, if you will, in conservative circles in Orange County. Yeah, he was a dean of the Chapman Law School, but he ran for attorney general in California. I think he once ran for Congress, would always lose. So he was just sort of some guy here, would side, you know, against marriage equality. But he got into Trump's radar when he wrote a widely discredited and laughed at essay claiming that Kamala Harris probably was not eligible to be vice president of the United States because her parents were immigrants. And so while the rest of the world laughed, President Trump said Eastman was brilliant. Hey, you want to come on? Because I'm going to have some issues with this election coming up.
Yeah, that was published, by the way, in Newsweek magazine. I remember that. What is he being accused of vis-a-vis January 6th? I mean, how does he tie into the insurrection?
So right now, he's not being charged with anything. But the House Select Committee, they want to know what he was telling, what he was telling President Trump. So with this court ruling by Judge David O. Carter, who, of course, has notoriety here in Orange County for being blunt and no nonsense, Carter ordered the release of emails that Eastman said was protected by attorney-client privilege, and they talked specifically about what was going on in January 6th, and specifically what he was telling not just President Trump, but also Vice President Mike Pence as to what could be done to decertify the election or stop the installment of Joe Biden as president of the United States.
How was Chapman University responding to Eastman's activities involving Trump and the election and what he was writing? I mean, apparently he was using the email address from Chapman, right? There's a connection there as well, which is a big no-no.
Oh, yeah. Well, moral of the story, folks, if you're going to be emailing stuff, no matter what it is, use your private email, not your work email. But Chapman had always just tolerated what Eastman did. It said, like, look, as long as he's doing it on his own time, we can't do anything about it. You know, it'd be very hard because there was always calls to fire Eastman over the years. You know, he was there for 20 years. I think he was there right when I started, but he was always controversial. But in this case, Judge Carter told Chapman, hey, you kind of let him get away with using his work email for this attempted coup. And Chapman's response is, we warned him. We told him not to do it. And by the way, if you send it, you know, Eastman says those were his emails. Well, no, if he was using his work email, there are emails. So we're more than happy to turn over whatever the government wants, no matter what Eastman might be complaining.
Was he still in their employ?
At that time, yeah. I mean, no.
If you're doing something that's a no-no and the university says don't do that and you do it anyway, I mean, that leads me to believe that maybe something there should be some sort of punishment for that, right?
Oh, well, it's academia, tenure. At the end, Eastman left Chapman. He was no longer the dean. He was just a professor there. He mutually agreed to retire. But no, trust me, a lot of friends of mine at Chapman were complaining, organizing to fire. And the president, Daniel Strupa, said, look, he has not, at least what the information that they had then, this is not a fireable offense. It's just not. If we fire him, now we subject ourselves to a lawsuit.
But the other colleagues at Chapman, what were they saying at the time, too, while this was happening? Were they?
Oh, he was an embarrassment.
About this? I mean, they were upset.
Yeah. No, they were upset. Most, I mean, especially folks in the humanities, the law school kind of just like grinned and bear it. But everyone else, you know, you had a campus-wide letter signed by a lot of my former professors, actually, saying that Eastman should be penalized one way or another. At the end, of course, he just resigned, and that was that. Then Chapman just moved on.
I want to read this from Judge David O. Carter in his ruling. If Dr. Eastman and President Trump's plan had worked, it would have permanently ended the peaceful transition of power, undermining American democracy and the Constitution. If the country does not commit to investigating and pursuing accountability for those responsible, the court fears January 6th will repeat itself. Those are strong words. This is the judge with a big red siren on top of the car, right?
Oh, yeah. And I mean, this is not some flaming liberal judge. This is a former veteran, Vietnam War veteran, a guy who most famously in Orange County has been trying to deal with the homeless situation here, and also in Los Angeles County for that matter as well. So Judge Carter, when he issues these words, he's not being light about this. This is a man who went off and fought for the United States. So when he says something looks like a coup in search of a theory, he means it.
Yeah, they weren't tourists.
No, they were not tourists.
Gustavo Arellano, columnist for the LA Times. Gustavo, thanks.
Gracias.
Well, that's going to do it for us this evening, but you can hear us anytime online at kcrw.com/GLA. You can grab the podcast, never miss an episode of Greater LA, and get it wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, share your thoughts with us at the website. And even give us some story ideas, too. What's a great LA story that we should be talking about? Let us know at kcrw.com/GLA. Tomorrow, what kind of relief will you get for California's high gas prices? Who gets a rebate? Do you get a rebate? You get a rebate. We'll find out tomorrow on GLA. Jenna Cagle, Andrea Bautista, Juliana Mayo, Sonia Geis, Reg Warna, Lorenzo Ponce de Leon, Amy Tuck, Christine Camito, Holly Adams, and Christian Bordall all made this evening's show happen. I'm Steve Chitakis. Have a great night.